From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America presents Issues in the News. The nation's top Washington correspondents offer their perspectives on the week's major stories. Your moderator is Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Issues in the News begins now.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for the Daily Beast. And here are the issues. President Obama entered his seventh year in office prepared for a struggle over politics and policy with Republicans who now control both houses of Congress. In the president's State of the Union address, he strongly defended his economic and foreign policy initiatives and said there is no longer a shadow of crisis over America. He also said his administration provides, quote, a smarter kind of American leadership, unquote, around the world. Meanwhile, the United States-backed government in Yemen fell, leaving the country in chaos. Well, it was quite a State of the Union address on any number of issues, but one thing it left, I think, clear, that all the talk by Republicans and the president about how ready they are to get together and compromise, it doesn't look like they're going to do it anytime soon, Stephen.
No. You know, the first thing to remember about State of the Union addresses is that we make a big fuss about them as journalists, but they have a shelf life of only a few days, you know. I think I've covered about 10 of these things, and I can only remember when President Bush said axis of evil, mm-hmm. when someone, Republican lawmaker, shouted out, you lie, mm-hmm. to President Obama, and when he angered the Supreme Court mm-hmm. by talking about campaign finance. So I wouldn't put too much stock in exactly what the president said the other day. The interesting thing about it to me was this was in many ways more of a campaign speech than a State of the Union speech. It was a speech in which the president spoke about himself and his political project as much as anything else. It didn't give much, you're right, sign that there's going to be any much done between Republicans and Democrats. The president, although sort of putting out a rhetorical olive branch, made it pretty clear that he's going to stick to his guns on various mm-hmm. issues like immigration and healthcare. On foreign policy, in some ways I thought it was a bit of a missed opportunity for the president. I think there were some U.S. allies that would be interested to hear his views on this new rising threat we have from, you know, lone wolf, homegrown jihadism in Europe, which U.S. officials fear could even spread to the United States following the Paris terror attacks and attacks in Ottawa and places like Sydney. And the president didn't really talk about that. He scotched over it. He basically made a case that he's turned the page on this 15-year period since the September 11th attacks when U.S. ground troops have been in Middle East wars and has sort of embraced a smarter, more sustainable campaign against terrorism, which sort of relies on empowering local partners. But as we've seen in Yemen this week, that doesn't always work out very well.
Tim, what was your reaction to the State of the Union address? You know, the White House is another thing I remember, Stephen, is that the White House in the days beforehand said, now this is going to be a briefer one. It's not going to be as long as they usually are. Ronald Reagan's were, you know, 30, 35 minutes. This State of the Union address was 61 minutes. Anyway, that's here and there. What'd you make of the speech in content?
Well, I think that I have a couple points. On national security, there's a lot of fudging of the details. You know, when the president says that we've turned the page on the past wars, well, you know, if you look at what the situation in Iraq and Syria today, as we saw it during the last State of the Union address, things have noticeably declined. There are only
a few. No, but the president, Tim, said that the advances of ISIL have been stopped.
Right, and that's just factually untrue, that if you look at the territorial control of ISIS in, say, Syria, you'll find that they've doubled since American airstrikes mm-hmm. began late summer, early fall. He said things to the extent that technology like drones are being restrained by his government, mm-hmm. when, in fact, the president that's overseen the most drone strikes ever, targeting and killing more than 4,500 people in the first 5 years of his administration. And so a lot of the things that he was saying on national security, while he wanted to send the message that the United States is turning a corner. The world is not quite allowing him to say that's the case. You can make the argument on economics, perhaps, mm-hmm. but on national security, that's a very difficult point to make in such a troublesome time in the world. And the second point I'd make is I think that there are issues that Congress can work with the president on. And
oh,
there
really?
Are
Let's
issues.
Hear them.
There are issues that Republicans have said, hey, we will sit down and work with the president on. They're not the biggest items mm-hmm. in the world. You don't expect them to be legacy defining, mm-hmm. but could they work on an authorization of the use of military force in mm-hmm. Iraq and Syria? Yes, probably they can do that. They both expressed willingness to come to the table and do some work on tax reform.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things that they can do on trade promotion authorities, which they both agreed is important, and Republicans especially are open to pursuing because they prefer freer markets. Those are the sorts of topics that you could get them to the table, mm-hmm. and that's not nothing over the last 2 years of a lame duck presidency.
Boy, just getting to the table, I actually agree with your point, Tim. Just getting to the table is going to be a major achievement on these things. Let's start with trade. You know, the president, actually, for the first time, he has been reluctant to push for the thing that's essential if you're going to ever get a trade treaty, and that is this so-called Trade Promotion Authority or Fast Track. And what it does is it means when the administration puts together a trade agreement, and the one they're talking about particularly is with the, 10 Asian Pacific nations. And what this does is the trade treaty comes to before Congress, and Congress has to vote up or down on it. It can't be, if you have fast track, they can't amend it to death. So you really have to have it. The labor unions, which support the president, are completely against it, and he's been reluctant to promote it, to talk about why it's necessary. But he did in the State of the Union address. He didn't say, I'm going to really hammer my supposed allies on this, but he mentioned it and said he needed it.
Right, and he does need it because one of the prime rationales of his foreign policy is this rebalancing towards Asia. This massive Pan-Pacific trade deal would cement that, and it would give the president a significant legacy achievement. What surprises me is, you know, I've been to Asia with the president a number of times, and he talks about it when he's in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And I know there are officials in the administration working very hard behind the scenes to sort of negotiate this pact, especially with the Japanese. But mm-hmm. then he comes back from Asia, and he doesn't mention it hardly at all in public again until the next time he goes to Asia. So there's not really been much of a political push by the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Democrats are the key demographic here for the president in terms of getting this passed. The problem is, I think there's a limited window when this can actually get through Congress. To ask Democrats running for re-election in sort of Rust Belt states to make a tough vote on trade in an election year is going to be very difficult. It's not clear to me that the negotiations in Asia will be concluded in time to allow a political process to go through to get that done this year. The other thing that if you talk to senior Asian officials, they say, well, we're going to have to make big concessions on this. And if we don't see a willingness from the president to invest political capital in it, and if we don't see TPA, we're not going to be in a political position to make those concessions. You could argue that the sort of sweet spot for the Japanese to make concessions on auto and agriculture subsidies may have already passed. So I think it's going to be difficult to get this passed. But, you know, maybe I'm too cynical.
You know, Tim, the one thing this sounds like minutiae, but the one thing I was looking for in the speech of the President's State of the Union address was whether he would mention Fast Track Trade Promotion Authority. And he did, but he just mentioned it and said, well, I need this. What do you make of it? Is the president going to be tough enough to get his otherwise allies to fall in line, pass it? And then a treaty can be ratified by Congress.
Well, this is the paradox that Stephen was mentioning, right? The best time to possibly have something like this come before Congress is early in the Congress,
yes.
which is now or in the next few months. But then there are the negotiations behind the scene to actually get a treaty mm-hmm. before the Congress, which likely won't come so early. And mm-hmm. so since they can't do it early, they're going to have to do it late. And that makes it much more mm-hmm. difficult politically for any of these Democrats, which the president desperately needs to get on board.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not exactly raucous in their applause when the president brought it up during the State of the Union.
No. Republicans weren't cheering either.
but Democrats certainly weren't ready to jump up and clap yeah. mm-hmm. for the idea of trade promotion authority. So this is going to be a difficult lift, but it is still one of the three or four things mm-hmm. that Congress and the president might actually do over the next 2 years.
Stephen, let me ask you about a couple of the other things that the president said. You know, I thought he seemed to say that because he and some of the European countries had stood behind the principle that, as he called it, the bigger countries can't bully the smaller ones. He was referring about Ukraine, that was enough. And I was thinking, wait a minute, did have the Russians under President Putin retreated from Crimea and eastern Ukraine?
Right. I guess that's the principle that the administration says it operates under. And it's also talking about China in Southeast Asia when it mentions that. I think you can really question the effectiveness of the administration's efforts to sort of restrain Russia. You could argue that the president has actually done pretty much everything that's feasible to do with the Europeans, given their resistance to sanctions. There mm-hmm. are people in the Republican Party, especially, who say it's now time to start arming the Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. Critics of that approach in the administration say that, first of all, that the Russian military advantage is so massive that giving them a few weapons wouldn't make a difference, mm-hmm. and that would exacerbate the situation. But yet again, the president's remarks were somewhat undercut by the reality on the world stage. People who disagree with the president say that, you know, he's delusional. That was a word a lot of Republicans used.
Mm-hmm.
The other side to that is, well, if you took the policies of, for example, Senator John McCain, who's much more hawkish on Russia, would the situation be worse? Would Putin be deterred?
Mm-hmm. You'd hear something, Tim, that the president said. I'm reading from the State of the Union address. He said, "We stand united with people around the world who've been targeted by terrorists, from a school in Pakistan to the streets of Paris. We will continue to hunt down terrorists and dismantle their networks, and we reserve the right to act unilaterally." And he went on. But as Stephen was saying when we were talking before the show, he didn't really emphasize the terrorist attacks in Paris. He didn't go to the march there and didn't even send his vice president or anybody. And this is sort of, as Stephen mentioned, I'll give him credit. He could have, for instance, had the French ambassador to the United States sitting mm-hmm. in the balcony at the invitation of the president. No, he didn't. He had a young couple from Minnesota, I believe, or Wisconsin that had benefited from some government programs. What about that? Did the president do enough on the subject of terrorism?
It's one thing to say, hey, I support the freedom of expression. It's another thing to take a forceful stance and actually bring it up and make it a topic of conversation and make a commitment to it. And the president has not shown that he's all that interested to get into that fray, that he was not willing to send senior administration officials to Paris for the march in honor of the Charlie Hebdo victims.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't even mention the magazine by name in the State of the Union address.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And not to mention that there were plenty of Democratic lawmakers who were clamoring for him to do so.
Yep.
That there were over 50 lawmakers who committed during the State of the Union address to hold up and wave a yellow pencil in honor of the Charlie Hebdo victim. And they were ready to do so at the mention of Charlie Hebdo during the State of the Union address. And the president never did. And they did cheer a little bit during the very brief mention of mm-hmm. Paris. But, you know, some of the biggest critics of this administration are from the left, from Democrats who mm-hmm. think that the president should have done more mm-hmm. to stand up for the victims of the Charlie Hebdo attacks.
You know, some, and not just conservatives, but most of them are conservatives, have complained about the president's language in describing the terrorist threat. And he referred to, in his State of the Union address, as violent extremism. He seems unwilling to use the word Islamic jihadism or Islamic extremism. Why is that, do you think?
I think there's a strain of thought within the administration, first of all among foreign policymakers, that suggests that if you sort of tag this as Islamist violence, you're giving the perpetrators too much credit and giving them the ability to argue that they're fighting, you know, on behalf of Islam in a wider sense. To me, it's, you know, I mean, this has exercised some conservatives. I'm sort of sympathetic to their arguments that you should call this what it is, but mm-hmm. at the same time, it's somewhat of a semantic debate. I mean, I'd mm-hmm. be more interested in, instead of European leaders linking arms in a march and the president saying how much he supports them,
mm-hmm.
but someone coming up with some idea about exactly how we're going to combat this mm-hmm. new rising jihadism. So, you know, I think the politics of terrorism often obscures the real nature of the issue. You know, one sort of, not to defend the administration, but if you look at the intelligence that's been used to wind up cells in Belgium, a lot of the tracking of the movements of the Paris terrorists to Syria and Yemen, that's all U.S. intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a great deal of behind-the-scenes cooperation between the Americans and the French and other European allies,
mm-hmm.
particularly within the intelligence services, that we're not seeing. Mm-hmm. So while we can sort of fault the president rightfully for some of the sort of imagery, I think the fact that this cooperation is going on is significant.
I'm going to get to you in a minute, Tim, but first we're going to take a break. As I remind listeners, this is Issues in the News, coming to you on The Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Tim Mak of The Daily Beast and Stephen Collinson of CNN Politics. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issuesinthenews. Tim, you can add anything if you want to about this rather small point, actually, about the phrase violent extremism. But if you don't, let's turn to the question of sanctions against Iran. We know that the negotiations over the Iranians' nuclear program, I think they're in there now, their third phase, and there is building support in Congress, Republicans with a few Democrats as well, who want to impose stronger sanctions that would go into effect when the deadline on this third phase ends. The president said that would upset the whole apple cart of negotiations. What do you make of that?
Well, yeah, the president has said that he will veto any sort of additional sanctions. He said that in the State of the Union address. His administration officials have been pushing hard back on congressional leaders who are interested in having these sanctions. This is a bill that would only kick in if the talks were to collapse or Iran were to show evidence that they've cheated somehow on the agreements thus far that have halted their development of nuclear weapons. There is some bipartisan support in Congress about this. I wouldn't say it's the broadest bipartisan support I've ever seen. But there are Democratic senators who are taking the lead, such as Senator Menendez of New Jersey. It's interesting that there's a lot of debate even within, say, Israel about the appropriateness of additional sanctions. I mean, we learned yesterday that the Mossad has been advising American lawmakers not to go ahead with sanctions, just as the Israeli government was saying, you know, we could go along with these sanctions that kick in if talks fail. There's a lot of actual legitimate debate about the wisdom of putting in sanctions while the negotiation process is still underway.
Stephen, now that Israel has entered the conversation here, the House Speaker, Boehner, a Republican, has invited Bibi Netanyahu, the head of the Israeli government, and someone who's very familiar to Americans. He speaks great English and is on American television all the time. But anyway, to come and give a speech to Congress. And this was really sort of a shot across the bow to the administration, because the Obama administration on Iran, not necessarily on this present issue of sanctions, but they are not on the same side in dealing with the Iranians.
Right. This was a really sort of delicious political moment when Speaker Boehner sort of announced the morning after the State of the Union address, when the White House was sort of basking in all the great headlines that it was getting, that Netanyahu was coming to address Congress. You know, there's nothing unusual about a foreign leader coming to address Congress, but I think it's the fact that it's this foreign leader who has a very tense relationship with President Obama.
I like that tense.
Yeah. the fact that neither Speaker Boehner nor Netanyahu informed the White House before the announcement that he was planning to come. The White House, you know, sees this as a clear attempt by Netanyahu to, as they see it, yet again intervene in domestic U.S. politics. My view is that this may actually backfire a little for the Israelis, just because, as you said, the momentum was building among some Democrats to vote for some kind of sanctions bill. Now, the fact that Netanyahu's coming is going to ask Democrats to side with a foreign leader, albeit one with which the United States has very close relationships, and their own president on a major issue of national security. I just don't think that that makes it likely that supporters of this bill are going to get to the 67 votes they would need to override a presidential veto. The other thing, of course, is that Netanyahu's up for re-election in the coming months. He's trying to make the re-election about national security, as he often does, even though there are some sort of pressing economic questions in Israel. So Netanyahu is also playing his own sort of version of political chess. In terms of the Iran issue, I just think it may well backfire for those who actually want to pass a bill on sanctions.
And also, my following up on Steve and Tim, is this going to be good for a Netanyahu to do this? You know, it's hard to imagine his relationship with President Obama getting worse, but it certainly could. This isn't going to help.
Right. Well, every time you think that it couldn't get worse, it does get worse.
Mm-hmm.
That that administration officials have gone on background to call him all sorts of names. Mm-hmm. And now that Netanyahu has apparently agreed to come to the United States, the president has denied a meeting with him.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all this back and forth.
And yet, you know, the main job of the president of Israel is to get along with the American president. You know, that's his most important job, and it doesn't seem to be working for Netanyahu. In the last several minutes here, we need to mention a couple things. First is, you know, the president's policy and what you talked about in the State of the Union is to, rather than send American troops to countries that are beset by terrorists, to partner with their governments. Now, one that the U.S. had backed in Yemen, Stephen, has collapsed.
Right. The government of President Hadi has fallen to Houthi rebels from northern sort of highlands of Yemen. The interesting things about this is, as you say, that Yemen was a key cog in President Obama's sort of refashioned mm-hmm. global terror campaign. The question now is whether the new government, with which the U.S. has very limited contacts, will allow U.S. drone strikes to carry on against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula targets. The Hadi government was also sort of providing intelligence to the U.S. to sort of allow them to target those drone strike. So that's one issue. Having said that, the Houthis are also sworn enemies of al-Qaeda. They mm-hmm. just don't necessarily want foreign intervention in their country to go yeah. after al-Qaeda. So mm-hmm. I think there's some sense that a covert intelligence relationship mm-hmm. with this government might mm-hmm. be possible. The other point about this is that the Houthis are backed by Iran, and this sort of underscores Iran's growing reach across the Arab world, places mm-hmm. like Damascus, Beirut, mm-hmm. and now Sana'a in Yemen. And this also came as we saw the death of King Abdullah,
mm-hmm.
who was increasingly alarmed by Iran's march across the region and was a backer of the Hadi government. So mm-hmm. the whole sort of Gulf region this week is mm-hmm. in even more turmoil than it was before.
There's chaos in Yemen, Tim, but mm-hmm. The one thing we see in Saudi Arabia with the death of King Abdullah is continuity.
Well, that's what we're seeing in Saudi Arabia is yes, yeah, some version of stability. You know, it's a close U.S. ally, and I think a lot of policymakers are probably holding their breath to see how it turns out precisely. You know, Saudi Arabia has been an American ally, but in many ways it has an atrocious human rights record
mm-hmm.
That the United States has never been all that willing to acknowledge given their close ties with the Saudi government. As for Yemen, it's a double whammy in the sense that the United States has lost a crucial ally in the war on terror, and it's also given a power vacuum in the country for al-Qaeda to expand its reach. Let's not forget that just days ago, the attacks in Paris were, to some extent, logistically organized and supported by al-Qaeda based in Yemen. That al-Qaeda based in Yemen has been behind many plots against American aviation, including the notorious underwear bomber. This is a real hot zone for al-Qaeda. What Afghanistan was in 2000-2001, it's kind of much of the nexus of extremism in the world has shifted towards Yemen. And so the loss of a crucial ally there, the United States was, for example, using Yemeni's territory to launch drone strikes against al-Qaeda positions there. That's all gone. That's all disintegrated kind of overnight.
We have about a minute to go or so, and my last question is this. The president's going into his final 2 years in office, out of 8 years. Normally, not much happens in the last 2 years of a president's term. What about this one, Stephen?
I'm not sure that we have the luxury, the way the world is right now, for not much to happen.
Mm.
But having said that, you know, foreign powers begin to look in the last 2 years towards the U.S. succession, the next president of the United States. So I think we're going to have this interesting internal political debate in the United States about Hillary Clinton, the presumed Democratic nominee, or at least candidate for the nomination. She is going to be tied by Republicans to everything that the president does in foreign policy
yes.
over the next 2 years and over the last 6 years. You already heard this week Republicans talking, and Mitt Romney particularly last week, he talked about the Clinton-Obama foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole U.S. election debate is going to be bound up in foreign policy and what happens overseas, and it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, what about Congress, Tim? It doesn't appear, with Republicans in control, that the Republicans are going to do much more. You cited the areas where they might reach agreement, but generally the relationship's going to be hostile the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's going to be quite hostile. There are going to be a lot of bills you know, conservative bills passed by the Republican-held House and Senate. And, you know, I think the last 2 years will be characterized probably less by that even, but that mm-hmm. the last 2 years tend to be times administration overreach, of scandal, mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. places where people get a little too comfortable in their lame duck years. Mm-hmm. And we'll see what happens. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that these are interesting times mm-hmm. because they tend to lead to scandal.
Yeah, well, good time to be covering Congress. Stephen, good time to be covering politics. Anyway, that's all we have today. Joining us were Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tim Mack, senior congressional correspondent for The Daily Beast. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.
From Washington, the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Issues in the News. You can email your questions or comments to our panelists. Send them to voanews@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune in the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us next week at this time for Issues in the News.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Amnon Reshef. He's a retired general with the Israel Defense Forces who served as the 14th Brigade Commander in the Yom Kippur War of 1973. General Reshef is the author of We Will Never Cease, the 14th Brigade in the Yom Kippur War, published in 2013. Major General Reshef was also commanding general of the Armored Corps from 1979 to 1982. He retired from active military service in 1984. Last year in November, Major General Reshef organized more than 100 retired IDF generals and Mossad leaders in signing a petition directed at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, urging him to engage moderate Arab countries and be courageous in creating regional peace. It is called Commanders for Israel's Security. Speaking to the press recently in New York City, Reshef said that the goal was to influence Israeli perspectives and opinion, which he says have been brainwashed for over 40 years with settlements in the West Bank and Golan Heights. Although he has been critical of the Obama administration on some points, Major General Reshef has also blamed Netanyahu for endangering Israel's critical relationship with the United States. So, how will the Palestinians' recent attempt to internationalize their campaign for statehood by joining the ICC, International Criminal Court, and other world bodies complicate the search for a two-state solution? This gambit coming at a time when the Fatah-Hamas leadership struggle continues and when Israel is preparing for elections in March has raised the profile of long-simmering problems following a summer of intercommunal violence and open warfare in Gaza. We'll discuss the current status of relations between Israel and the Palestinians, as well as prospects for resuming peace talks with our special guest, retired Major General Amnon Reshef. Major General Reshef, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
And we are delighted.
And Mohammed as well.
Thank you very much.
Mohammed El-Shenawi, thank you for joining me. Thanks. Well, Major General Reshef, first of all, talk about what brings you here to Washington and what prompted you to establish the Commanders for Israel's Security Initiative.
I'm here in Washington, D.C. to meet some of my colleagues from some other peace organization, some politicians, and some other organization in order to cooperate in the near future and on the long-term basis. It's different discussion between the various organizations, but we have our main goal, which is to bring some peace arrangement between Israel and the neighboring Arab countries, including the Palestinians.
Major General Reshef, excuse me for being a little pessimistic, but again, you know, we are in the aftermath of the war in Gaza.
the tension surrounding, you know, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, also known as Haram al-Sharif, the Palestinians' bid for statehood via the United Nations, a failed U.S. initiative to broker an agreement. I mean, what makes you think that now, you know, you can resurrect, you know, this initiative for peace in such a dismal context?
No question that there are a lot of obstacles and difficulties, but one should think what will be in the future. No question that with all the terror action which was conducted in Paris and elsewhere, it doesn't support our effort. But I think that the only way to go to have a solution for two states, for the two people, which is Palestinian independent state and Israel as a Jewish democratic country.
Indeed, and before I turn over to my colleague Mohammed, I just have one more question. You talk about appealing to the current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu by matching the so-called Arab Peace Initiative with, you know, an Israeli initiative. Remind us of the Arab Peace Initiative and to what extent it still remains a viable option. I'm assuming you're talking to those who promulgated it, the Saudis and others. Are they in on, you know, what you're proposing?
Okay, the Arab Peace Initiative was launched back in 2002. Since there are already 12 years when it was launched, the Arab country leaders, they came to the conclusion that they have to moderate the initiative and dealing with some facts. You know, over the years, Israel has developed some settlements, some blocks of settlement. So right now, it's accepted by the international community and the Arab world as well that these three blocks of settlement will be a part of sovereign Israel. And with a kind of land swamp.
Land swaps.
Yeah, the Palestinians will be concentrated accordingly. Now, there are some other subject matter. Before, when the API was initiated, it was a kind of conditional term. So once the Israel will come to some settlement, peace settlement, with the Palestinian, then the other Arab and Muslim countries will establish some peace relation with Israel. It's not a condition anymore, and it can be conducted equally. Mm-hmm. So one step in the Palestinian side, and then it will be another step on with the other Arab countries as well. So it will be done simultaneously and not conditionally, as it was originally planned. Then there is another major issue, which is the Golan Heights. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depends on the point of view, we don't have any kind of Syrian partners. Who is Syria?
A good question.
Yeah. So right now, the Golan Heights, it's not a subject matter that can be or should be discussed because we don't know what will be in Syria in the future. As to the relevancy of this API, each and every year, the Arab League reaffirmed the initiative. So it's valid initiative that should be considered. Now, in our letter to the Prime Minister, we are not asking him, take it as it is. What we are asking him, listen, there is an Arab peace initiative. It might be a good basis, a good start. And please, lead, make your own Israeli initiative. And then we can start with negotiation with the various parties. Now, if somebody is reading carefully the letter, it's a very polite, non-aggressive letter, and we urge him to enter into this peace negotiation. We are telling him, but at the end, once you go ahead, we will support you. Unfortunately, although the letter was provided to the government on the 30th of October, it's already almost 3 months, no response for the Prime Minister.
That's interesting. I was just going to ask you what impact it is having. You just told us. Well, let me turn to Mohammed for a question.
General, how would you define the parameters of such an initiative that would come from Israel to combine the Arab initiative and Israeli concerns?
The main issue which concerns the public of Israel is security. Because as we know, only a few days ago, there was a terror attack in Israel. Secondly, It's already, until last summer, 14 years the Hamas launched rockets and missiles from the Gaza to Israel. Now, one should imagine how mother can raise their kids worrying every minute, every second, that a mortar will kill their son or girl. When I think about my grandchildren are going under this atmosphere, it's unacceptable. So we have to make sure that Palestine should be demilitarized. They can have some small arms, light armored vehicles, in order to secure their homeland. Otherwise, they shouldn't have, and I think that they don't want to have, tanks, aircraft, artillery, and not even rockets. So we have to make sure that no tunnels will be digged in the West Bank, because they are so close to the Israeli settlement and villages inside the Green Line or the Israeli border. And there are some other subject matter that should be discussed. I think that the Jordan River should be a security border of Israel. We have to make sure that no terror organization are crossing the valley of the Jordan River, entering the West Bank, threatening the Israeli people. And I'll tell you, I think that the Islamic terror movement, they are threatening not only Israel, but only the moderate Arab countries, and specifically the people of Palestine. So we have to take the necessary arrangement to make sure that the two people, so to say, the Israelis and the Palestinians, will have quite healthy, good life.
But how about the borders? Remember President Obama went to Congress a few years ago asking for their support of an initiative to restart the negotiations based on the June 4th, 1967 borders with swapping portions of land on each side. Then Prime Minister Netanyahu was invited to Congress and refuted the whole initiative, and then everything collapsed. So what kind of vision your initiative have for borders of the Palestinian state?
It should be based on the 1967 lines with some adjustment according to the demographic and the security requirements of Israel. Now, the future border between Palestine and Israel, it's almost agreed by all parties. It might be that there are some minor differences between the parties, and it can be reachable. And it should be reachable by mutual understanding. And we spoke about land swamps, so they will be concentrated according to some pieces of land that will be a part of the future Israel, so to say, the three main blocks of settlement, which are well known.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is retired Israeli Major General Amnon Reshef. He is the founder of Commanders for Israel Security. That's a movement representing more than 150 retired high-ranking security officials that aims to accelerate efforts toward a two-state solution between Israelis and Palestinians. I'm Carol Castiel, and joining me on the program is VOA Senior Middle East Reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, connect with us on Facebook, or send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. And here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Amir Shakil from Karachi, Pakistan. Well, back to you, Major General Amnon Reshef. You said earlier that you got no response from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. This is not a very positive sign. So the question is how representative are the signatories of, you know, of this letter, of your initiative, and to what extent do you think you reflect Israeli public opinion? Because we hear about lots from the settlers, ultranationalists, some of whom are really just have given up on peace with the Palestinians, for whom, you know, the threat from Iran and perhaps Islamist extremism in the region are higher priorities. How do you combat these great, you know, obstacles? And again, to what extent are you representative in your approach?
By now, We have already 170 journalists in our movement. We are going very fast each and every day. Now, you know, there are extremes on both sides. But the question, what think the majority? Now, according to polls, which were taken over the last couple of years, about 80% of the Israeli people are supporting this two-state for two-people solution. So a lot of Israelis are willing to solve the problem once they will be sure that they can secure their family, they can secure their children. And we are here as generals, as experts on the security. You know, we carry more than 5,000 years of security on our shoulders. So we know what is security. By the way, I didn't mention it. We are all volunteer. We don't have any self-interest, not political, not economic, just our only interest is the future of the state of Israel. So therefore, we are very objective, and we think that it can be achieved.
Well, General Amnon Reshef, it's very impressive that you and other generals are promoting this, because as you said, of all people, you know the cost of war and the importance of security and a peace agreement. Similar to perhaps the former heads of Shin Bet who recently spoke in a film, The Gatekeepers, talking about that there was a necessity of trying to solve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict urgently. So if you're not getting any response from the current prime minister, to what extent is this initiative timed to coincide with the upcoming Israeli elections in March?
According to the Israeli laws, we are not allowed to support or reject any party. What we are going to do is just to educate, to persuade the Israeli public that peace can be achieved while we are securing the interests of Israel. We have members from the right parties, center parties, left parties. Mm-hmm. Actually, when somebody is coming to be a member of our movement, we don't ask, what party do you support? I don't care. Once he adopts our vision, he's a member of us. So we don't identify ourselves with a party or some parties. We are non-partisan movement without any connection to the parties. Now,
well, that makes you all the more credible, even.
Yeah. It gives us a lot of strength. And as I mentioned before, as we don't have any kind of personal interest, it gives us also the strength because we are objective about it. Now, we are going to approach all the party leaders, and unfortunately, we have too many of them, and trying to provide them our vision and trying to persuade them. Although the Prime Minister didn't answer our letter, we are going to approach him once again to meet him, to get his response, and see what will be. And then the public will decide.
Well, Major General Reshef, before I turn again to my colleague Mohammed, I just have a question I'm going to quote from your letter. You said to Prime Minister Netanyahu in your letter of October 30th, 2014, we are in the midst of the memorial days marking the fallen of the Yom Kippur War, a war that stemmed from the political blindness of the Israeli leadership. And of course, you were the 14th Brigade Commander in the Yom Kippur War. And you go on to say that we are concerned that similar blindness will thwart the opportunity before us. Talk about the comparison between then, 1973, and now.
By now, we know that the 1973 war, Yom Kippur War, can be avoided if the leaders on both sides, the Egyptian side and the Israeli side, would be more effective, more aggressive in the right way. Right now, we think that there is an historical opportunity. You know, with all the countries in our region, they are two main enemies. One is Iran, and the other one is a group of the extreme Muslim movement with all the terror that they have conducted. Now, it's a threat that's threatening not just Israel, but all the other countries as well, because they threaten Jordan, they threaten Egypt, the Saudi Arabia, and
now,
the Gulf state.
Are you referring primarily to ISIL as well as Al-Qaeda?
Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Hamas.
Okay, you are throwing
Hezbollah.
Hamas. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, there are several groups, and they are threatening, by now, they are threatening the cultural world in Paris. It was not only against Jews, it was also against some naive reporter who were working in a newspaper. So let's go back to our region. All the moderate Arab countries and Israel have the same interest to fight or to cope with those two threats. And therefore, it's a kind of historical opportunity that should be used to settle all the conflict in our region. And by not doing it, by ignoring the opportunity, it wasn't 20 years ago, but right now, there is an opportunity, and we have to use it to solve the problems.
So, General, do you think the regional realities like the so-called Islamic State and the rise of radicalism in the region would create some sort of urgency in Israel to reach a comprehensive peace with the Palestinians and the entire Arab world? Or, like every other Israeli elections, hopes are rising, then dashed after the coalition is formed by threats of the right wing to boycott or withdraw from the coalition if the prime minister would go ahead with the Palestinian peace initiative?
First of all, I don't know what would be the result of our general election. And after the election, we'll sit down and see what strategy to adapt or to adjust. I think that you actually mentioned two subject matter. All the Islamic extreme movement, terror movement, they are threatening, not, as I said before, not just Israel, but all the other countries as well. So it's a common interest, regardless who will be elected in Israel. I think that by now, it's not just a Middle East problem. It's a developed world issue. It's the European issue as well, because we know what happened in Paris only recently. I'm not speaking about the terror action in Tel Aviv or elsewhere. I'm speaking about Europe, about Paris.
But even Israel now is bordering the Islamic State. That's even an urgency for Israel to move and get rid of a grievance by some that's being used by ISIS to recruit fighters.
Yeah, but ISIS recruits fighters from Israel, from Palestine, and from Europe. I think that from Israel there are just few who went to ISIS. But I think that the interest of Israel, first of all, to enter into such security arrangement with the neighboring countries, and then we can cooperate, we can share intelligence, we can share measures, and we can then, together with the international community, fight against these threats, whether it's in Syria, in Iraq, or elsewhere.
So if Prime Minister Netanyahu ended up to be the winner in the elections, would he change his approach to Middle East peace? Or you are betting on a new face that would come and start a real peace negotiations?
I don't know what will be the agenda of Mr. Netanyahu. If he will not enter into this peace negotiation, we will have to act accordingly. Because, you see, otherwise, it will be just one state for two people, which will be the end of the Zionist dream. And Israel will be either not democratic country, or it might be even minority. So I don't want that my kids and my grandchildren will live in such an environment.
Well, General Amnon Reshef, with all due respect, we have heard this argument before, the demographic argument. We heard it many years ago. But we are now where we are without any real movement. And we have now the Palestinians joining the International Criminal Court, going through the United Nations. This is a major impediment, is it not, to your vision? And
yeah,
it must be a challenge for you to persuade Israeli public opinion as well as political leadership, whether on the right or the left.
I think that the recent Palestinian steps were a mistake. Not to say that the Israelis, they have not done some mistakes. It happened to be that both sides, the leaders of Israel and the Palestinian Authority, become to be more and more extreme. Now the question for us is to see whether we accept it and what will be the future. Whether we should be quiet, passive, or we should be active. And I think that Israel should launch some initiative which will be accepted by the Arabs and by the international community, and it is achievable, and that is our goal.
So do you see any regional role in facilitating such initiative? Do you see a role for Egypt, Jordan, and what do you think of the future role of the United States after its failure in bridging the gap between the two sides?
I think that each and every Arab country has its own role. I think that Jordan has a very important role cooperating with the Palestinian Authority and with Israel in order to prevent any penetration of radical Islamic movement to Jordan / to Palestine or to Israel. We have the common threat. I think that Egypt has very important role. I think that it, as I understand, that General Assisi, the Egyptian president, is a leader and he can lead the coalition or the group of the Arab countries towards the right negotiation with Israel. I think that Saudi Arabia, actually, Arab Peace Initiative resulted out of the King of Saudi Arabia initiative.
Right.
So it is legacy. And I think that, therefore, he might have very important role, especially in Jerusalem, as the holy city, the holy place for the three religions. And one shouldn't ignore the financial aspect. And I think that some of the Gulf state will have to participate in financing to improve the Palestinian way of life in order to have quality of life, and then they will understand that they might lose if they will follow all this extreme terror movement like the Hamas and the Hezbollah and the others.
Amnon Reshef is a retired major general who served as the 14th Brigade commander in the Yom Kippur War. He's the founder of Commanders for Israel Security, and that's a group of more than 150 retired, high-ranking security officials pressing for the Israeli political leadership to embark on a regional effort to respond to the Arab Peace Initiative. Well, General Reshef, we cannot thank you enough for coming in and sharing your insights, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much, Carol and Muhammad. It was my pleasure to be with you and to discuss the subject matter with you. Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Dave Magnus. And joining me on the program was VOA Senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.